For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. We've got a quarter till four right now, and we got dinner after this, so we want to get started on time. Why don't I pray for us, and then we'll begin. God, we're real grateful for this conference, for the speakers that you've assembled. I really feel like you have showed up last night and today with a message for us, and I pray that you would continue to speak over the next hour and 15 minutes as we lay out some information as well as some application about this very elusive and mysterious age group of high school and college students. We pray that you would give us even just one or two things here over the next 75 minutes that we can take and apply in our ministry so that you ultimately can be glorified as people come to know you. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, our subject today is reaching high school. Oh, hey. What just happened there?
Can't close it.
Can't close it?
No.
Oh, here we go.
Oh,
okay. Reaching high school and college students in an age of cynicism. My name is Scott, and this is Conrad, and we're going to be the speakers on this. This is a subject that we're both pretty passionate about. We're both pretty invested in. We wanted to tell you just a little bit about ourselves before we begin. I became a Christian about 12 years ago as a senior in high school in Cincinnati. I grew up in the church, but just never really got it until that point. I came to Ohio State University to go to college, and I found Xenos' campus group there, and I've pretty much been involved there ever since for the past 11 years. I got married 5 years ago. I came on staff here at Xenos full-time 3 years ago, and my daughter was born 9 months ago, so I became a father last year. Conrad has also been here roughly the same amount of time. He became a Christian in high school, I believe, at Xenos, is that right? Mm-hmm. And then has been involved with the college group ever since, for the past 9 or 10 years or so. And he's been on staff for the last 2 years. So it's the two of us and a few other full-time people and a few part-time people that run the college and high school ministry here at this fellowship. The main thesis that we want to present here, or the main problem that we're facing, is that we're losing our kids. You know, Dennis laid some of this out last night, just as he was assessing how the American church as a whole is doing. And, you know, the American church has got a lot of problems, but it seems like we're particularly ineffective at reaching this current generation of junior high school, college students. Josh McDowell in The Last Christian Generation, this is a quote Dennis had in his as well, he said, in past years, between 55% and 66% of churched young people have said that the church will play a part in their lives when they leave home. Now only about a third of the churched youth say that. He says many have estimated that between 69% and 94% of their young people are leaving the traditional church after high school, and very few are returning. He goes on to say that even the kids that are still in church, really, you can't even tell they're Christians because they're not living out the biblical worldview. This is kind of hard to read, but the top bar is Christian youths, and then professed Christian youth, the bottom bar is non-Christian youth. We're satisfied with their ethics and character. 91% of the Christians were, 90% of the non-Christians were. Physically hurt someone when angered within the past year. You can see 63 versus 67%, almost no difference. Lied to a parent is identical. Lied to a teacher, almost identical. Cheated on a test is almost identical. And so even the kids that are hanging around, it seems like it's not getting through to them. And that might be part of the reason why young people are losing interest in the church in large numbers. David Kinnaman, in his most recent book, Unchristian, this just came out last year, what he did was he surveyed what he calls outsiders, young outsiders, which is people aged 16 to 29 that are not Christians. And he says this is a group of about 24 million people in the United States. And he says one of the primary words this group used to describe their impression of Christians is hypocrite. According to his research, 84% of young outsiders personally know a committed Christian, but just 15% thought the lifestyles of those Christ followers were significantly different from the norm. He asked them to react to the word evangelical, and about 10 million of these 24 million were unfamiliar with the term. 7 million, about 28%, had a bad impression. 7 million had a neutral impression, and less than a half a million had a good impression of evangelicals. Now, it was a little bit higher for Christians, I think partly because of the political connotations with evangelical. But still, this is pretty bad. I mean, it's there's just a real negative view of biblical evangelical Christianity. Another author, this is a secular book called Generation Me. She talked about just in general weekly attendance at religious services. She said with high school seniors across the nation, it's 26%. Even if you go down into the South, the Bible Belt, it's still less than a third high school seniors are attending any kind of religious service, much less Christian or even Bible-believing Christian. If you just go to the next age bracket up, once they leave home, that number drops below 20% down to 18%. And this is particularly disturbing when you look at charts like this, which have been reproduced many, many times over the last 100 years, which show that the age when people usually come to Christ is in this range here, from 10, 11 up to 22, 23, 24. And so if we're not reaching this generation, I mean, I don't think it's going to get easier when they're in their 30s and 40s. I know that hasn't been our experience here. It actually gets harder if we miss our window here. And so if we're missing the most receptive window, that spells real doom for the future of Christianity here in America. I really agreed that, with some of the things that Driscoll was saying about America really just becoming more and more like Europe is, which is one of the hardest fields in the world, really to penetrate with the gospel in real ways. And so, we're in real danger here if we don't get this turned around. So let's talk some about the millennials. Okay, now, believe it or not, Generation X is kind of, yesterday's news. I mean, the oldest Xers are turning 29 this year. The millennials are really, sociologists define it, anyone born after the year 1980 up till around the mid-90s. And I know that, there's not hard and fast, it's not like somebody born in 79 is totally different than someone born in 1980. And yet there are certain trends that can kind of be generalized. Anytime you generalize, you run into problems. But there are certain trends. There's certain ways that this generation acts and thinks. That's what we want to talk about here. And we feel like at Xenos, we have had some success. I don't know why this isn't working. Just switch to this. I feel like we have seen some success in reaching this age bracket. If our college and high school ministry in 1997, which is the farthest back I could get data for, we had a little under 200 students. We had about 6 home groups. And 97 was really the first year that these millennials had started to, they were kind of in high school. They were starting to enter college. That was about the size of our student ministry at that point. Now we've got over 1,200 students. We've got about 50 home groups. These home groups are pretty sophisticated house churches that are, most of these are led by Xers and millennials. So we're not just doing shallow evangelism, but people are actually being won over to biblical followers of Christ, discipling other people, teaching the Bible, doing pretty sophisticated things, for kids and really for any kind of Christian. They're doing more than a lot of Christians do in their entire adult lives. And so we want to share some of the things we've learned, and we're not saying we know it all and we've arrived or anything like that, but we at least want to share some of the things we've learned in our experience over the last 10 years working with this age range, as well as some of the things we've learned recently through some different books that we've been reading. And ultimately, the thesis that we're going to advance is this right here, is that really, the key here is we need to get millennials grounded in biblical truth while helping them get a vision for God's plan for their lives. We need to get them grounded in biblical truth while helping them get a vision for God's plan for their lives. And Conrad is going to talk more about the truth end of things. He's going to talk about this all-pervasive cynicism that characterizes this generation, cynicism toward many things, especially cynicism toward truth and what that has brought about. And then I'll talk more about the effect that it has had on individual lives, and there's like kind of a hyper-individualism that this has produced. So let me turn things over to Conrad here. And we have to switch this microphone, but not the other microphone. This.
I guess just like reaching you, changing microphones is pretty complicated too. So before we begin, I kind of wanted to highlight what Mark Driscoll talked about last night. I feel like he kind of stole some of my thunder. But either way, you know, as we refer back to Acts 17, I think is really the premier passage that we have that kind of gives us an understanding of how do we contextualize the gospel. And I think one of the really great parts about it is the fact that Paul, as he was going through the city, he was observing lots of things. He was immersed in the culture. And he came across this unknown God. And that was kind of his launch pad for talking to the Athenians and the Areopagus to say, you know what, this unknown God that you don't even know about, this person, this individual, is actually the God of the Bible. And so I think really I want to kind of show you maybe two pieces of that, or two observations that I think is very helpful for us to understand how do we contextualize in general. Because I think, you know, as we talk about what millennials do and what they're into and what they're thinking about, the thing is that one day, probably very soon, all the things we're talking about is going to be very obsolete. And so I want to really convince you to kind of do the hard work of getting immersed in the culture and trying to figure out how you, in your local community, in your local context, can figure out how to understand the people who you're reaching and how to do it effectively. So the first thing that I want to kind of mention about Acts 17 is that Paul immersed himself in the culture. You know, even beyond seeing this monument to this unknown God, we read later on in his speech to the Athenians that he refers to this Greek poet. And people were probably pretty impressed by that. He understood their culture really well. And then the second thing that I want to mention is that he also, too, used that as kind of the launching pad for giving the gospel to these people. You know, he must have realized that this unknown God, probably in the minds of the people, represented the inadequacy that they felt towards the known gods that they had. That he just wasn't big enough. That there was something missing there. And so Paul says, you know, this unknown God that you don't know, let me tell you about him. He's God, the only God. That's why you feel like these unknown gods are insufficient. And so based on those two things, I think we have kind of two things that help inform our understanding of how to reach the culture that we live in. Number one, that we immerse ourselves in the culture, and then that also gives us a launch pad into understanding how to approach the gospel. Not necessarily that we should change the content of the gospel, but instead that it helps us to understand what key area do we need to focus on related to the gospel that will give us an entry point into the culture that we're trying to reach. And so with that, I think we can talk about the barriers. You know, in our experience, we've worked with lots of students for nearly a decade, and we just wanted to share with you guys, really in humility, what we think are some of the real key barriers to reaching college and high school age students. And I want to suggest that really the main barrier that faces many young people today in being reached for Christ is an all-pervasive cynicism. An all-pervasive cynicism in almost every area of life. And this is something that, you know, as I continued to teach Bible studies, I started to get keyed into just by talking to a lot of students. You know, you think about different TV shows, you think about different types of ways in which information is communicated, and you see cynicism is just broadcasted kind of throughout our entire culture. You think about many young people today, And there's actually studies that show that one of the main ways in which young people get their news is through The Daily Show and The Onion. I don't know if you know what The Onion is. I'm sure a lot of you guys know what The Daily Show is. But you know, The Onion is kind of like, it's sort of a parody of a lot of news organizations. And there's some pretty funny stuff in there. I have some clippings here to kind of give you an understanding of this. I remember growing up in Chicago, my first experience with The Onion was picking up this newspaper on the subway. And I opened it up, and I was like, could this be true? And I was confused, and I realized later on that it was actually a joke. But here are some things that I found online that I thought were pretty funny. Here's one, if you can't read it, it says, could leaning with your head against the wall cause depression? What's the underlying kind of message there? You know, I mean, it's couched obviously in a joke, but at the same time, it suggests that, you know, there's kind of a huge epidemic of depression, and is it really all legitimate? Are we causing it, are we bringing this upon ourselves? What about one that's maybe aimed a little bit towards Christians? Doing God's work, does it let God off the hook? what about this one, that kind of political humor? Obama practices looking off into the future pose. Kind of give you maybe a little short reading of it. He says, when performed correctly, the pose involves Obama standing upright with his back arched and his chest thrust out. His shoulders are positioned 1.3 feet apart, open slightly at a 14-degree angle, and his eyes transfixed on a predetermined point of between 560 yards away. Advisors say this creates the illusion that Obama is looking forward to a bright future, while the downward corners of his lips indicate that he acknowledges the problems of the present. And so although this is funny, I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, it kind of captures the truth of what people feel, the underlying cynicism that they have about many areas of life. And one of the things that's kind of hard about this whole idea of cynicism is that it's hard to kind of nail down. It's hard to object to, because a lot of times the people who are making these criticisms are pretty funny, and they can make you look like a fool. But in a more serious way, I think that cynicism touches many areas of our lives that I think makes it very difficult for us to reach college and high school age students. The first thing is we see that there's cynicism of people. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of this comes out of our experience. You know, a lot of us have been in a relationship, we've trusted people, we've given our lives to an organization or a company, you've served the church, only to what? Get kicked in the teeth? And so as a result, you find that there is kind of this underlying cynicism once we feel hurt in some sort of way or disappointed, in which we feel like we can see an underlying motive behind what people are really trying to do. Think about the statements, you know, I know that this person has moral conviction, but everybody has a price. What about the idea that When a guy walks up to a girl just trying to be friendly, somebody comments, oh, he's just trying to get into her pants. That's what all guys want anyways. What about a deeper type of cynicism that is put out by evolutionary psychology that suggests that really all we are a bunch of nerve endings that seek desire. And at the end of the day, all that we really do is impression management to get what we want. Who wrote this book called Seeing Through Cynicism, which a lot of my insights have been gleaned from, has a pretty interesting quote. He says, we're only bundles of desires and a mask worn to satisfy those desires. There's no unique essence of who I am that is durable over time. I'm the product of countless accidental factors in my culture and individual experience. I'm fluid. I don't struggle to find or discover myself. I choose to invent myself. This is no cause for despair, but for relief and exhilaration. It's exciting. I'm free to project what images I want into the world to make the world work the way I want. This is really at the heart of cynical, postmodern thinking. This is at the heart of the way many youth see themselves. They're fluid. They change over time. Here's an interesting clipping from this book by Kenneth Gergen called The Saturated Self. Talking about a woman and her daughter going to a shop and buying a dress, and she says, on Saturday, we went shopping with my teenage daughter. We needed a dress for a party the next week. I some very attractive black and daring cut with a silver sequin. I was very excited until I tried it on. Dejectedly, I had to tell my daughter that I just couldn't take it. It wasn't me. My daughter responded with gentle mockery, "But Mom, that isn't the point. With that dress, you really could be somebody." See, the mother is coming from more of a modernist understanding. She has a more secure sense of self that's anchored, unchanging. And so really, her clothes are just a representation of what she sees in self. Whereas the daughter is more postmodern in the way that she sees herself. That it's fluid, it's ever-changing, that you can reinvent yourself. And that the things that you do and the culture that you're around really determines who you are. And so I think that at the end of the day, the problem that we find with cynicism, in terms of cynicism towards people, is that as people see themselves as simply managing other people's impressions, they feel imprisoned by that, but at the same time sense that the people that they're trying to get close to, they wonder whether or not they can really know this person because maybe they're doing the same thing. And so there's a cynicism towards people. Let's go even further. What about cynicism of institutions and government and family and even church? Think about government, for instance. You know, you think about Michael Moore put out this recent movie called Fahrenheit 9/11, and it was an expose, supposedly, of how George Bush had ties to Osama bin Laden. And so there's a cynicism. There's an underlying belief that there is an omniscience about other people's motivations. What about in marriage? I heard of once a divorced man decided that, you know what, instead of getting married, what I'm going to do is I'm going to find a woman that I don't like and just buy her house and give half my stuff to her. You know, the idea is that the divorce rate is so bad that we are just cynical of the institution of marriage. And you see this all the time with a lot of younger youth, too, who have grown up in divorced families and have decided, you know what, I'm never going to live and get married. Because of that bad experience. Some people have gone even further and say, you know what, the fact that people get divorced is actually good. Because the idea that you make a vow till death do us part suggests that one day you are going to be caught in a contradiction where you are going to have to limit yourself and that it's really disingenuous to do so. And so really the person who is the true postmodern person who understands self constantly reinvents themselves. And so divorce is an opportunity for itself. What about cynicism towards the church? I don't think you have to look very far to see maybe cases where people have decided, you know what, I don't know if I can really trust the church. They say one thing, but really, in the way that they live their lives, you see that there's a contradiction. The two things are incongruent. And in a lot of ways, I think that as Christians, we have to admit that the history of the Christian faith has been mired with bad things, and we have to admit that. But really, people have seen the institution of the church as being something that is an underlying power structure meant to hold people back. What about cynicism towards knowing truth? And really, another way we can say this is postmodernism. I'm sure most of you guys are familiar with this. But postmodernism began in a lot of ways, on a very basic level. It began with language, with guys like Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault. And these guys basically started to ask questions like, well, what about this problem that we have between meaning and language? And the power structure that's kind of behind language that are used to oppress people. And so what happened was, as people started to have suspicion about our capability to know things, it had some pretty strong ramifications. It had some pretty big collateral damage on our idea of truth. So that if we can't understand what people are really trying to say to us, if we can't really understand the meaning of words, then what do we really have? There's no truth at all. And so as a result, we find that we live in really a postmodern world today. I remember one time I had this experience where I was sitting down with this young student, And we were talking about the Bible. We were talking about different doubts that he had. And so I started laying out all these different arguments. I said, man, there's pretty good reasons to believe that God exists and that God loves you and wants to have a relationship with you. And, you know, he was kind of nodding his head in agreement. Yeah, I could see that. And so he started bringing up these objections, and I brought back some different arguments. And, you know, at the end of it, he was just kind of silent. I thought to myself, yeah, we got him. He's got nothing to say. And then he replied with a statement that just shocked me. And I couldn't respond to it. He said, well, you know what? All of that stuff really makes a lot of sense to me. But at the end of the day, there's just no way that either one of us can really know God. I was stumped. I drove home that night just incredulous, like, what happened there in that situation? And I realized what happened. The trump card that he'd been holding the entire time that he pulled out on the table was the fact that neither one of us could know truth. And it's because of this postmodern suspicion, this postmodern cynicism towards truth. And so really, I think, as a result of this postmodern suspicion, what this has ultimately led us to, and maybe is a replacement to, the idea that our beliefs can actually correspond with reality, is this idea of pragmatism. I call this the fallout of postmodernism. That I believe that many youth today have gotten to a place where they no longer believe that whatever's true for you is really true for you, but rather you want to look for the outcome in your life that's determined by your own value system that you make up, and you live your life to get that, and that's what's good, that's what's true. You know, many people today, you'll ask their youth and say, you know, do you agree with this statement? Whatever's true for you is true for you, and they'll say, yes, I believe that. And so, you know, that Christian apologist or the person who's been equipped in their church will say, well, there's no way that that's true. That means that you're going to be ultimately relativistic in the way that you look at everything. And I think really that's kind of an overstatement of what they're really trying to say. I think maybe what they're really trying to say is, when I look at a Muslim person and I look at a Christian person and both of them give charity and alms and they do community service, I see that both of them have good outcomes in their life. And so if their belief system causes them to do a good thing in their own eyes, and this other person believes something different and it causes them to do the same exact good thing, then what's the difference? Pride matters. That's what matters. And so really, I think that's where people are at, is that they have decided what matters most is my own ideals, my own values. And ultimately, I will do whatever it takes to get that, that good. And so really, I think the appeal of pragmatism is that it directs people's lives without really having to consider the truth. Asking the question, what is really true, is kind of a confusing question, you know? We just went to this conversation in the last session, and that was one of the things that was brought up, and I agree with that. You know, sometimes it's hard to understand truth. So instead of having to bother with that, I determine my own ideals and my own values, and I can do whatever I need to do to get that. And I think that's where a lot of high school students are at. But I think that there are some dire consequences to this pragmatic view of truth. I just want to list a couple. First of all, I think that there's a dwindling interest in apologetics or this idea of really knowing whether or not the Christian faith is really true. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't you feel that way? If there's no way for you to really get to what is out there, reality, what's really true, then why would you be interested in something like apologetics? I know I have lots of conversations with people where I say to them, so why do you believe in God? You know, is it because you believe in the historical resurrection? Is it because you believe in the inerrancy of the Bible? Is it because you believe in the literal death and resurrection of Jesus? And they say, well, my faith doesn't necessarily need to hang on that. And I say, why? And they say, well, because my life is so changed. And other people's lives are changed. And the Christian life is so fulfilling. And I would say, well, that's true. But the problem with that is the reason we live our Christian life isn't because it produces a good thing, but rather because it's true. And the problem is that when we don't emphasize really teaching people how to defend their faith, if we just really go after their felt needs, what happens is that they go to college or they go to their high school, and you have professors and teachers who have an axe to grind against Christianity, and they are accusing the faith. And yet, there is no response on the other end of the line. Simply silence. And so you find that this creates fissures within the faith that they have that ultimately leads to them losing, to not believing. That happens all the time. And really, I think pragmatism has led to people searching after Christianity in order to get God to meet their needs. In a lot of ways, you'll find that people will say, I go to Christianity because it makes me feel good. You know, it meets my needs. There are good relationships there. And I'm not saying that those things are bad. But the problem is, that's not the reason why we should live our lives for God. I have a real fresh example of this. You know, one of the guys that I've been mentoring for a number of years, from his freshman year to his senior year in high school. You know, I've been working with him, and we've been studying the Bible, we've been praying. And there was a real long period of time, maybe about 5 months, at the end of the senior year, where he was, like, really struggling in his faith. And so he said to me one day, he said, man, I think I'm done. I don't think I could do this anymore. And I was heartbroken. I was just like, man, 4 years of investment, all this time that we spent studying the Bible, all for it to end like this. And he said, man, you know what? I've spent the last 5 months studying the Bible, praying, and serving, all the things I should be doing. And I'm so depressed. My life isn't changing. And I said, you know what? I said, that may be the case. But I said, when you talk to somebody who's from a different part of the world, who when they make a decision, realize that, you know what? I might get persecuted for doing this and making this sort of decision. Why do they ultimately do it? And I answered for him. I said, the reason you do this is because it's true. That's why. Because at the end of the day, your experience may run out, but at the end of the day, you still have to cling on to the truth because you know it's true. And so sadly, I think that this is the main thing that is ultimately causing us to lose our kids. And it's the main barrier, I think, for us reaching college and high school age students. So I want to turn this over to Slim and, or Scott, I'm sorry. I affectionately refer to him. But either way, I want him to talk a little bit more about how, you know, the fallout of pragmatism is really hyper-individualism. That's pretty apparent.
Cool. And we'll actually, Conrad will come up to tack a few application concluding points onto the things that he's presented here after I'm done presenting my half here. Okay, so like he said, the wreckage left behind from postmodernism, pragmatism, the cynicism about institutions, people, God, truth. You know, if you can't trust anything, if your entire life mantra is, I just do whatever works for me, then that really, I mean, that's an approach to life that just puts the self, it puts you at the center of everything. And so there's a hyper-individualism that, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, humans at one point were not selfish and self-centered and now they are. I mean, ever since the fall, you know, when we wanted to be like God, we've been struggling with this, but now it seems like there are sociological factors that are facilitating and even nurturing this perspective, and it's real destructive. So kids were brought up, one of the big things they were brought up on is this notion that you are special. Gene Twenge in Generation Me says, the number of psychology and education journal articles devoted to self-esteem doubled between the 70s and 80s. And then journal articles on self-esteem increased another 52% during the 90s, and the number of books on self-esteem doubled over the same time. Another author, in the book Millennial Makeover says over 9,000 books were written about self-esteem in children during the 80s and 90s. Fewer than 500 books were written on the subject during the 70s. What she's done in this book is she's taken surveys that have been asked for several decades now, since the 50s. And she's got like 1.4 million pieces of data, I believe, in this going into this book. So there's a lot of authority and credibility behind this. And there's different surveys, like self-esteem surveys, that they've given people for a long time, how they feel about themselves. And she said that as the 70s kind of drew to a close, self-esteem was at an all-time low. I don't know if disco's to blame for that or what. Now, I think it was partly just because as the family continued to disintegrate, they realized, man, our kids, they have a real low view of themselves. And so there was this concerted effort, this self-esteem curriculum, really, was introduced into the programs. She says, by the mid-90s, the average Gen Me college man had higher self-esteem than 86% of college men in 1968, and women were higher than 71%. She says, in 97, a survey of teens asked, in general, how do you feel about yourself? What do you think teens would say to that? A stunning 93% answered good. Of the remainder, 6% they felt not very good, and only 1% actually admitted that they felt bad about themselves. Another survey found that 91% of teens describe themselves as responsible. Who are these teenagers? 74% as physically attractive, and 79% as very intelligent. One children's book, first published in 1991, is called The Lovables in the Kingdom of Self-Esteem. I am lovable. Hi, lovable friend. My name is Mona Monkey. I live in the kingdom of self-esteem along with my friends of the lovable team, the book begins. On the next page, children learn that the gates of the kingdom will swing open if you say these words three times with pride. I'm lovable, I'm lovable, I'm lovable. Here's another coloring book. This is the Be a Winner Self-Esteem Coloring and Activity book. As you can see, everybody's number one in a self-esteem culture. But he's first place, he's the honor roll, she's number one in music. Even the cat is number one cat on this picture. The dog's the only one that apparently has low self-esteem. He's not. He has no ribbon. The author says that's why he must drink from the toilet or something like that. A friend of mine just finished up his year teaching fourth grade, and you know, on the last day of school, he had to come up with an award for every single person in his class, because you've got to give everybody an award, because everybody's special, right? Everybody's number one. I don't think they're quite connecting the dots that when everybody's special, nobody's special. Yeah, exactly. And I think kids realize this. I don't think they're that stupid. You are special. Many school districts across the country have specific programs designed to increase children's self-esteem, most of which actually build self-importance and narcissism, which means self-love, narcissism. One program is called Self-Science. The subject is me. Why bother with biology? I'm so much more interesting. The author writes. Another program is called Pumsy in Pursuit of Excellence. It uses a dragon character to encourage children to escape the mud mind they experience when feeling bad about themselves. Instead, they should strive to be the sparkle mind and to feel good about themselves. The magic circle exercise designates one child a day to receive a badge saying, I'm great. The other children then say good things about the chosen child, who later receives a written list of all the praise. At the end of the exercise, the child must then say something good about him or herself. Boomer children in the 1950s and 1960s gained self-esteem from a stable, child-friendly society. Gen Me's self-esteem has been actively cultivated for its own sake. You know, it's like there's this factory producing self-esteem and canning it and distributing it to all these kids. And it's an artificial, strange way of pumping self-esteem into really, you know, everybody that was raised since the early 80s. You don't need anyone's approval is another mantra that this generation has been raised on. You know, if you're special and nobody can tell you otherwise, you know, that kind of leads to, you know, you don't need anybody's approval. As the author writes, you know, she said back in the 60s and 70s, we questioned authority. Generation Me disregards it entirely. She talks about a journalist who began teaching classes at a local community college after he'd been working for about 10 years in the field. And he says, students seemed uncomfortable with the idea that he knew more than they did, and even with the idea that my knowledge and skills were important or even relevant. Student after student balked when he corrected their essay, several complaining that his comments were just your opinion. She's a PhD, she's an instructor as well, and she's like, you know, there was one time where I decided to review the results of a test with everybody so they could follow along, and she said, it was the worst day of my life. Because students weren't saying there was a grading error, they just thought I was plain wrong. She's like, I'm never going to do that again. One instructor actually advised this guy. She said, what you should do is what I do, where on the first day of class, she announces, I have some expertise, you have some expertise. My job is to facilitate this process. Please call me Beth. The message, we're all equals here. I might have a PhD and years of experience, but that doesn't mean I know any more than you. Classrooms are increasingly structured for teachers to be facilitators rather than authority figures. Lecturing is frowned upon. Collaborative learning is in. And here's the third one and final one I'm going to talk about is that you can be anything you want, just work hard and put your mind to it. If you're special, you don't need anyone's approval, you want to be an NBA basketball player, that's great. I know you're 5'3". But, you know, that's fine. If you work hard enough and put your mind to it, you can do it because you're special. And don't let anybody else tell you otherwise. These kids have such high expectations because the self-esteem has been artificially inflated so high and they've been told to disregard anything, any evidence of the contrary. And, you know, and they want to do great things and they believe they can do great things. And, you know, what this is leading to is an incredible anxiety, an incredible pressure on the self to be the thing I want to be. They have very high expectations as to the kind of affluence they should have, the material wealth that they should have. This is very important to them. In 1967, less than half of college freshmen said it was important to be well off financially. In 2004, this climbed to 74%. Okay, so 50% jump in the number of people that this was important. College kids spend $2.6 billion a year decorating their spaces, about $1,200 each on average. A dorm room. She was saying that they actually bring these dorm design consultants in now because their space has to be different and special. Average high school couple, $800 on their prom night, up from $300 just 5 years ago. I don't know what they're spending $800 on their prom night for. But, you know, it's the expectations are so high. And parents, you know, they don't realize the parents are just going deep into credit card debt to provide this kind of life for their kids. They've been raised, you know, they basically grew up as credit cards became very available. People were going tens of thousands of dollars into debt. You know, they were raised watching shows, you know, I mean, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous is kind of an older one, but, you know, Pimp My Ride, Cribs, Extreme Home Makeover, you know, it's all these just glamorous, you know, half-hour show on Shaquille O'Neal's home. They're just sitting there thinking, I really want that. I should live a life like that. I deserve. Advertising says you deserve to be happy, you deserve the best and nicest stuff, so you need this. And, you know, it's just created an incredible amount of pressure because they're living at a time where academic standards in colleges are getting much more competitive. Tuition is going through the roof. The job market is competitive. Housing is astronomical. Healthcare is astronomical. And so they're living at a time when there is a lot of competition and kids are just pouring their souls into, you know, doing their best, putting their mind to it, in order to really achieve the kind of life that they feel like they need and deserve. There's high levels of anxiety and pressure on self. I was talking to, I'll say that story. Here's a weekly hours of children. You know, the difference between hours spent on activity between 81 and 97. The time spent outdoors, I don't know if you can read this, but that's dropped by 50%. Free play by a quarter. TV actually has dropped by 13% since the early 80s. That was surprising. Eating, is down. School, though, is up 38%, which is not to be confused with studying, which is up 60%. I don't know what that means. School is up 40%. If they're already 5 days a week, what does that mean? I don't know. Organized sports, close to 90%. Household work, 140%. Visiting and traveling, 170%. A lot of this is the parents. They just feel like our kid has got to do everything. Our kid has got to be the cream of the crop. Our kid has got to succeed. And so kids are just, being whipped into this frenzy. And they got to be the best. Twenge says, so in this world where essentials like housing are so astronomically expensive, what message has Gen Me been fed? Save your money? If you're lucky to have a house, even if it's not a mansion? Of course not. In a world of individualism and consumer longing, we've been taught to expect more. And she gives a quote from Fight Club, Brad Pitt's character. He says, our generation has had no Great Depression, no Great War. Our depression is our lives. We were raised on television to believe that we'd all be millionaires, movie gods, rock stars, but we won't. And we're starting to figure that out, and we're very, very pissed off. That's an ironic statement coming from Brad Pitt, who is the definitive movie god. But, the point, this is like a late 90s. This is just it's a classic statement of what some of this generation and the later Xers are starting to wake up to. They had all these expectations. Some are just, it's like they're collapsing and they're moving back home. The past people got married, had a job, had kids. Now there's a new 10 years people are using to try and figure out what kind of life they want to lead. They had this expectation of what life was going to be, and then it's just kind of crumbled around them, even though they poured their soul into it. And they just don't know what to do with it. They're just sitting around trying to, expecting to have a job as a video game tester or something. Because they got to follow their heart. And they just don't know how to cope with this, okay? So all these expectations, and it's created quite a quandary for them. And, my own experiences, they really bear this out. 10, 12 years ago when I first started working with college students, we were constantly trying to push people to get off the couch. Why don't you try and go back to college? People were dropping out several times. They were happy to just do nothing. Whereas today, over the last 4 or 5 years, it's like it seems like everybody in my home church is in grad school. People who hate math are trying to do engineering degrees just because that's what they're supposed to do. It's been a definite change I've seen over the past 10 years working on campus. Different from Xers. The colleges are even saying this. I was talking to a guy who just went to his freshman orientation at Ohio State last week. He went to the thing for the engineers. And the lady came out and she was like, if you have a girlfriend or boyfriend, you should break up with them now. And they'll kind of laugh and she's like, no, I'm serious. Those things don't usually work out anyway. For the next 4 years, if you want to succeed, you need to do this and only this. Don't do any extracurricular activities. Engineering is your life if you want to succeed at this. He was also, a friend of mine has just gotten a job and he was saying that another school in town, the counseling program, they go ahead and advise people to just take a break from any relationships they're in. They said most marriages don't make it through the counseling program, okay? Most marriages fail by the time the person is trained to be a counselor at this place. And these are the people counseling our marriages. The college counselors, another person he was talking to was a counselor at Ohio State for 4 years. 90 plus percent of the cases, she said, that they saw were depression and anxiety due to academic pressure. She said kids would come in all the time and say, I got a B on my test, I'm not going to listen to my iPod for 2 months. Partly to punish themselves and partly to focus. I got a B in OCHEM, I might as well drop out of school. Things like this. Just crazy perfectionistic thoughts that this generation is wrestling with. And I think it's just going to get worse. So, this is kind of the hyper-individualism where self is the center, self is special, and self just has to do everything in order to be happy. I got to get what's for me. I got to do what works, and that's getting the thing that I want and need. So let's talk about some application. Good. First of all, the self-esteem culture. Well, what needs to be resisted and critiqued about this is the world's approach to self-esteem. Right? I mean, they know that they're a balloon that's just full of air. There's no substance in there. And, you know, it's so shallow to just chant, "I'm lovable," three times, and that's what makes me special. I mean, deep down they know, you know, just like the idol to the unknown God. They know there's something there, they just don't know what to do with it. And so, you know, we can affirm, yes, you are valuable. You do. More concluding points about more related to the truth aspect of things, and then I think we'll probably have a little time left for questions.
Okay. Well,
about 20 minutes.
Okay. My little bit is pretty straightforward. The first thing is that I think that as we engage people in our culture, that we need to be transparent, and we also need to give their opposing views or, you know, their misconceptions about Christianity fair treatment and charity. I think the thing that we kind of get lost in is that a lot of times we're talking to somebody, we're trying to engage with them, and then as soon as they bring up their objections, we get defensive, and we just don't even listen to them. Or we talk about their worldview in a way that's unfairly characterizing their view. And so I think that, you know, really to get at the underlying cynicism that I think is kind of the current that runs throughout our culture in every area of our lives, especially in students, I think being transparent about where we're at, our failings, our problems, and even our misgivings about things, and also being understanding and charitable about where they're at. And I think, too, part of the charity that we give to their views is going to require us to do the hard work of understanding them, of immersing ourselves in their culture. You know, when I first started teaching high school group, one of the really difficult things for me to incorporate in my Bible teaching was humor. Because high school students laugh at really weird things from my perspective. And so I realized that the key to understanding what high school students will laugh at is you just think about the most absurd, crazy thing possible, and you say that and they'll laugh. And it was kind of a hard thing for me to understand, but, you know, it took time for me to really immerse myself and talk to students and observe what they like. And so that's part of the, I think, the real challenge there, and maybe the biggest challenge is to just immerse yourself in the culture. In their lives, understand them, get outside of yourself. But that also does not mean that we should give ourselves over to gimmicky approaches. If you want to reach students, real non-Christian students who are unchurched, going out and spending $100,000 on a video system or a video editing system or spending $1 million on a worship service to make it better and more contemporary, that may help out. But at the end of the day, a gimmicky approach is even something that they will be cynical about. You get somebody who gets up there and is real flashy and tries to do something that's kind of cutting edge, and everybody's going to roll their eyes. I remember one time when I first got hired on, we were trying to figure out a way that we can communicate to all the students to send out large communications. And so I kind of convinced our leadership team, I said, you know what? Students don't check their email. What we should do is we should get on this MySpace thing. And we should start up a group and try to invite everybody, and maybe I can come to the CT and try to like broadcast that on the PowerPoint and try to get everybody to log on. And so when I brought that up, people were like, are you kidding me? They like started booing me and like throwing their Bibles at me. That didn't happen. But, I mean, you could tell that there was kind of like, seriously? I mean, you're trying to organize something that's cutting edge like that? I mean, that's kind of crazy. But here's kind of the ironic thing is that now that the newest thing is like Facebook, right? And so I haven't solicited anybody to like be my friend or anything like that. At least I won't tell you that up front. But either way, like I've got like a couple, 300 people who are from the high school group who are my friends. And so it's kind of like, anything that seems organized, anything that seems to try to really penetrate the culture in a way that's kind of gimmicky is something that's kind of viewed with suspicion. And so I think really at the end of the day, don't buy into the gimmicks. Don't go and do the thing that you think is going to be cutting edge, that's really going to reach students. What you have to do is you need to get to know them. Immerse yourself in their lives. Understand their doubts. Talk to them about where they're at. That's what they really want. Don't buy into the gimmicks. It doesn't help. And finally, I think that as we understand where people are coming from, we need to teach and preach apologetics. Recently, we did kind of an apologetic series in our CTs, our central teachings, and wow, the overwhelming majority of people were so interested, especially the non-Christians, who were like, we have never heard this before. And it brought up a lot of questions and a lot of dialogue that we wanted. But we won't know where to scratch if we don't know the itch. And so we need to be out there with the culture, understanding. And I think also, too, for our students, the ones that we already have who are believers, we need to really fortify their faith by letting them know, hey, there are real reasons for why you should follow God apart from your experience. Because it's true. And I've got some scripture passages that I want to share with you. Here's one from Paul, 2 Corinthians 5. He says, since then we know what is to fear the Lord, we try to persuade men with the truth. There's a persuasive aspect about truth. And then really, I think the premier passage on this is 1 Peter 3. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. Do your students know how to give an account, a defense, of why they believe what they believe? Because if they don't, then they won't be able to reach people. And they're in danger of really losing their faith. As we live in a secular world that just casts suspicion and cynicism in every area of life, including their confidence in biblical faith. So that's our presentation. We didn't know if you had any comments or questions. We also added our email addresses there, so if you guys want to email us maybe for some resources regarding the books that we used or we read to kind of glean this information, we'd be happy to send that to you. And you can ask us now,
too. We've got about 10 minutes, it looks like. I think we're supposed to let out at 5. Is that correct? Yeah, so it's 10 till right now. So, yeah, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's along the lines of what I said in my conclusion about Acts 17, is that as we understand the culture that we're working with, the people, and, you know, the students, it'll help inform us in the approach that we take. And I've done that before where, you know, I've talked to a student, and I know that they're from a broken family, and I'm trying to actively reach out to them, and that I'll say, you know, I know that you've complained about your family and how broken it is and how messed up it is, but you know, God loves you and he says he wants to be your father. You could be a part of his adopted family. And that just resonated with him. And so that's not the only picture of the gospel that we have. It's much broader than that, but at least it's an entry point that I think resonates with them. And I think that's the reason why maybe Paul and Jesus and all the New Testament authors give us so many different types of illustrations for what the gospel looks like. Because they were trying to get them to a place where they felt like they could really resonate with what God was really trying to say to them. So that's a great point. Yes?
The last 5 or 6 years, I've been in LA for about 9 years, and the last 5 or 6 years, I've been speaking more about the life of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Younger youth pastors always want to be primarily
Right.
So, and of course, 2 seconds later, I'm like, you know, I'm going to basically not slam as in you're going to burn in hell if you play these games, but talk about why God does not want us to, you know, partake in violence. And so my question is, how would you answer to what we can do to help youth pastors today who are dealing with the youth to be God-driven and not culture-driven in the church?
Okay. Did you want to answer that one?
That's a big question. I was wondering the same thing.
I mean,
that's a massive question. I think, you know, I mean, ultimately it's got to be, I thought Driscoll had a lot of good suggestions last night for, you know, trying to get in touch with and analyze and understand the culture and then comparing that to what it says in the Bible. And really, I mean, the challenge that we've got to face here is what needs to be resisted, rejected, critiqued, and then what can be accepted and contextualized too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's contextualizing versus contending. And I think there's a lot of aspects, you know, I mean, I don't know how I would contextualize video game violence right off the top of my head. But I mean, ultimately, it's got to be a process of trying to weigh out which are the most important issues here. And, you know, there might be some people that think that the whole video game violence thing really isn't as important of an issue as some of these other things. I do think rather than talking about what they shouldn't do and what they should stay away from, I think a positive vision for what their lives could be and a positive, you know, teaching them truth, constructing a biblical worldview in a positive way, that's the kind of thing that people in general get excited about, okay. And students are no exception to that.
Right.
And I think if we just come in with a negative, here's what we need to resist in culture, here's what we need to stay away from, I don't know of many students that are going to be real excited about that. So we've got to come up with a positive vision for what we want them to be and not what a negative as much of what we want them to be. Don't be, not be.
And I do that, but the hard part is the youth pastors tell me sometimes, and they obviously brought me in to speak to them about the address, but at the same time, their justification is we want to relate to the youth out there that don't know Christ. We want to invite them in, but they're using tactics. At the same time, 2 weeks later, they're telling them don't partake in it, and yet they're doing it.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange mixed message.
Yeah.
And it's hard because in the schools don't allow Christian messages to be promoted or portrayed on campus. So it's like, what do you do today besides standing on the public sidewalk and hope you don't get sued?
It is. It is a difficult thing. I think one of the stances we take is that we know that if we ban that kind of music or video games, you know, while we're around, that they're ultimately going to do it somewhere else.
Probably more,
right. And so I think what we try to do is we try to actively critique that and try to show and unmask kind of the fallacy of their thinking and how ultimately there is a worldview problem behind the things that they say. I remember one time I attended a wedding where the person who was officiating the wedding actually gave a sermon based on one of 50 Cent's songs called 21 Questions. And it was really savvy, and I think that everybody kind of resonated with it because they realized, you know, he just unmasked kind of the shallowness of the way that people think about relationships. And so I think rather than saying you should abstain and you need to do this, I think we, like Slim said or Scott said, we need to come in with a positive message and also unmask the thing that we feel like is maybe trying to push this value system across to our students. Yeah. So hopefully that's helpful.
Another thing we wanted to get into but just didn't have time to is
right.
how much these kids communicate and how little relationships they have. Mm-hmm. And how if we can actually build loving communities, I mean, that's a witness that can't be banned anywhere.
Right.
And it's something that's impossible to do in any kind of a real sense without Christ. And so if we can actually build youth groups that are loving communities based on truth, then that's going to be so attractive to the watching world.
Yes, well, just a comment briefly on that. I think Bruce writes about the expulsive power of the accountable. So I think you're right. I think telling them what not to do doesn't work as well as giving them excitement for what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so you look at what is Paul's priority when Paul writes his prayers down in the epistles. He doesn't say, I pray that they stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He prays, I pray that they really
Time for any more? We got 3 minutes.
Okay.
So,
yep.
Just a quick question. It might kind of fall outside the actual presentation, but I'm just curious. Kind of one of the things that that they said last night was a general hardening of the soil, and I'm just wondering if you guys have any experience or any thoughts on like evangelistic methods such as like Great Comfort, Sir Cameron, Mark Cahill, more of a confrontational present the Ten Commandments, whether it's being beneficial for the Gen Z and millennials.
I mean, I can't think of anybody that, especially any non-Christians or people that have come into our group and received Christ that had even heard of those guys. The ones that have heard of people like them usually have super negative views of them. And they're like, you guys are great. You're nothing like all the other Christians that I see around. So we're not big fans of those.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really helpful for us is when we talk to people that you could tell that sometimes they'll put a little bit out there to see whether or not we'll critique their lifestyle or whether or not we'll just outright critique what they have to say. And I think that if we can kind of hold back on that and continue to ask questions and invest over kind of a long-term period, that's where I think we've seen a lot of the success is just investing long-term with people on a personal basis. And really being bold in the sense that we say, so, you know, what's holding you back really from, you know, Christianity or, you know, knowing God or believing in God? And let's talk about that. You know, I'd like to be able to see what you have to say about that. So we do take a direct approach, but we do it, I think, more in a long-term sense with people. Joe Boddy was before, sorry. Sure. I think that a lot of times people probably don't believe that there's really any good reasons for believing in Christianity. And so I think that a lot of, and also I think it caters to kind of the consumerism that's kind of endemic with our entire culture, where it's like I go to church in the same way that I go to Target to get what I want. And so I think that, you know, in the same way, we have to introduce, you know, hey, there's more to Christianity than just how you feel about it or these felt needs being met. There's a basis for it. And I think that teaching apologetics, although a lot of times people are like, really? I mean, are they really interested in that? I think it really sparks a lot of good conversation. I know a lot of students who you know, have said, you know, I never thought about that, and wow, that really just provokes me to think about this more, and I'd like to hear the next week's teaching that's on, you know, the next topic or whatever. So it's been pretty good.
Part of the resistance to it might be, too, that part of it's a mental laziness, but part of it's I just don't think they believe that there's really answers out there,
right.
And so they've given up on finding answers. And if you can present it in a way that's exciting and interesting, that could be good. I don't know. I've lost my thing.
Indeed, you have.
Well
do we have any more?
We have Bill. 5 o'clock, so we should probably...
sorry about that.
Call it a session.
Yeah.
It worked out.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.